Hello everyone and welcome to today's podcast, where we will chat with Professor Herman Swart on his approach to assessment. I am LZ Leroux.
And with you, Hanley Arndorf, and as always, I'm excited to be here.
Now let's talk transformative assessment. Professor Herman Swart, welcome. Welcome today and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Wonderful. Maybe just to start off with, Herman, just give us some context on, you're from the Department of Psychology, right? And maybe just share with us modules that you teach, with obviously the lens of assessment.
So in the Department of Psychology, I'm involved with a little bit of first year teaching, but my main responsibilities at undergraduate level relate to coordinating a third year social psychology module. And so one of the unique challenges with a third year module is in many programs that's an exit level module. So I find, even though I'm very aware of graduate attributes at first year level, of course, I'm a little more focused on that, a little more intent on that at third year level, because I'm thinking, what are these students going to leave with at the end of the year? And you know, so that informs my teaching, it informs my assessment.
Yes, and I think third year in psychology is even more interesting given the many students that might want to continue and the competition around that. But Herman, I know you've got many interesting thoughts on assessment. I would like to start with some of the conversations we've had in the past has been about integrity of assessments, and specifically some of the interesting conversations with you have been integrity of assessments in the online uninvigilated space, a space that we really struggled with in COVID to figure out what to do in that space. So I wonder if you've got any thoughts on what, in your experience, what happened in your case?
Yes, COVID posed a very unexpected, very immediate, and very big challenge to module coordinators. I remember that the hard lockdown came into effect 2 or 3 weeks before my module was supposed to start. And so I had to very quickly shift from an in-person face-to-face format and start developing materials that would work in an online space. That would, for many colleagues, that also included shifting your assessments. And I was lucky enough that my assessments, I'd started dabbling in online assessments pre-COVID. And so I was a little bit ahead of the curve when it came to the online demands of assessing during COVID. So I was a little bit more prepared. But the nature of uninvigilated assessments, I was unsure whether what I had set up, what I had developed pre-COVID for my online assessments, which were invigilated on campus, just how well that would work in an uninvigilated space. So I was on tenterhooks in the lead up to my first semester test. And what I found was that my averages, my marks during the semester test, during the exams, did not differ by more than 1 or 2 percentage points during COVID compared to pre-COVID levels. Mm-hmm. And whereas many colleagues on campus were raising concerns about the fact that in their modules that suddenly needed to shift to an online assessment and an online uninvigilated assessment, their module averages were showing incredible jumps, massive jumps, to the extent where one had to seriously start thinking about to what extent does my assessment still have integrity, right? And it sort of confirmed for me that what I am looking to assess and how I am looking to assess it showed a certain level of robustness against the temptations offered by uninvigilated online assessments. So I could be very clear with my students in advance already and let them know, that, of course, the temptation is there to engage with your assessment using other materials, using the internet, etc. But that students who didn't understand their work and tried to take this approach would not be able to finish the assessment in time. Mm-hmm. And I observed that. So I could see, I could get a good indication if there was a student that was likely taking this approach of using Google or using a textbook, because I could see the first 40 questions were perfectly answered and then time ran out, mm-hmm. right? So by trying to assess for both knowledge, so just the basic knowledge of social psychology and understanding your theories or knowing the theories and the components, and assessing for understanding, it's that understanding bit that students could not get around using a textbook or using Google or other resources.
So it's almost like what I'm also hearing is that the time element sort of became the invigilator in a way.
Yes, so the time element became the invigilator. It was also a question of it's how you set up your questions in relation to the time element, right? So maybe I should just take a step back.
Yeah, please do.
Right, because the successes that I experienced, and I think that if you can keep your module averages within a normal range during an uninvigilated assessment compared to invigilated assessment is some form of success, I guess. Mm. The groundwork for that was set before COVID. So my third year modules, I normally have between 500 and 650 students.
Wow, I just wanted to ask how big are your classes? Because yeah. That's usually a factor as well.
Yes.
You know, people who are.
Yes, so with these large classes, it does pose particular challenges in terms of how you assess, the resources you have available for providing feedback, for marking assessments. I started teaching in this third year social psychology module in 2015. And I knew that I wanted to assess knowledge and I wanted to assess understanding. In order to assess understanding, I included additional compulsory readings in my module. So students would have to, they'd have research articles that I would give them. They'd have to read these research articles. And some of these research articles included important debates in social psychology. So then they'd have two research articles, one article arguing in favor of a particular position and another article arguing against a position, right? And then to test their understanding of these debates, for example, I'd have them write essays. So they'd write an essay about the debate topic and they'd have one debate topic per week. And they'd have to share or describe, introduce each position's argument, contrast these arguments, and then also formulate their own position in this debate. And there is no right or wrong answer, right? So it's all about being able to communicate your understanding of the material. And I was the only person marking in the module. So I couldn't mark weekly essays, but in their semester test, I would include a 50-mark essay question that they would have to answer. And it would be one of the essay questions that they would have prepared in the weeks building up to the semester test, but that I had to mark on my own, right? So I would have 50 marks worth of multiple choice testing theory knowledge, and then I'd have a 50-mark essay question. So in a semester test with 550 students, I also now need to mark 550 essays written under test conditions where it's very difficult to decipher a student's handwriting, etc. And then in the exam, which is 150 marks, it's a 3-hour paper, they would have 50 marks worth of multiple choice, and then they'd have two 50-mark essays to write. So for 550 students, those two essays, it's 1,100 essays I need to mark, right? And I did this for 3 years. And 1 year I did all this marking. So now you've got a 6 week module plus say a 3 week exam period. So over those 9 weeks, I'm marking 1,650 essays across the semester test and the exam.
That's a lot of marking.
It is a lot of marking. And the 1 year I did this marking with a slipped disc in my lower back.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Sympathy.
The pain was excruciating. And I asked myself, Herman, why did you do this for 3 years? And I did it for 3 years because I was holding on to, with determination and in many respects a degree of denial, I was holding on to this idea of, this is what I want to assess. I want to assess that students know stuff. I want to assess that they understand stuff. And I want to assess that they can formulate their understanding in writing. And but I was paying the price with my health, right? Because it also puts you under a lot of stress doing all this marking. So I stepped back and I realized this was not sustainable. I needed to find a different way, a better way of achieving the goals I wanted to achieve in my module. So the first thing I did was I stepped back and I reflected quite deeply on what is it that I really want to achieve with these students in the module? What is it that I would like to assess? So I realized, okay, what I really do want to assess is knowledge. I want to ensure that a student passes the module, if they just pass, if they get 50%, that they at least know the very basics of the theory, okay? But then I also want to find a way of distinguishing the stronger students from the average students. And this is where I want to test understanding. So I have this idea in my mind that a strong student doesn't just know the work. They can understand the work. They can apply the work. They can contrast the work. How can I do that without leaving myself 1,500 essays to mark? So I realized the quickest, the simplest way of setting up an assessment that can be marked very quickly is using multiple choice questions and using true or false questions.
And is that then online, right?
So, true, false, yeah. Yes. So the first step in my thinking was, what is the simplest format?
Mm.
And then can I make this even more convenient? So what would be the method of delivery? And so then online,
okay. Right,
came into the picture. So now I combine multiple choice questions, true or false questions, all in an online space. And I did this for the first time in 2019, and it was a disaster. It was a disaster. The first online semester test, I had to abandon the test after 30 minutes because the students couldn't log in. And I had to find a new space within the assessment timetable to redo the assessment. And I was telling myself, Herman, you wouldn't have had this issue if you had kept it paper and pencil. And I came very close to simply reverting back to what I knew. And often that's what happens when you're under pressure, things aren't working. It's sometimes easier to just go back to what was comfortable. But what was comfortable might not be the best thing in the long run.
Yeah, it's like back to that default position, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And so thankfully I said, we're going to do this online test again and we're going to keep it online. Surely I can't have the same problem twice in a row. And thankfully I didn't. And so what I found was that now setting up the test, I have to keep in mind things like time. I have to keep in mind, how do I assess knowledge? How do I assess understanding? There's this preconceived idea that any time you use a multiple choice test, that it's an easy test, right? I feel bad for multiple choice questions. They get a bad rap. because it's all about how you develop those questions, right? So of course, if you set up a multiple choice question that's just looking at surface knowledge, and sometimes the answer is even in the question itself, well, then of course the multiple choice question is going to be easy. But if you create, you can create multiple choice questions where that might be slightly longer, so they have more information that you need to read. You can sometimes create multiple choice questions that give students information, information that they might have thought they suddenly need to memorize, right? So I can give them the theory and say, given this theory, a logical conclusion would be that in this particular circumstance, applying this theory, these are, you know, which of the following are the correct outcome we can expect. So now it's not just about knowing the work, because I've given you the work. Now it's about, can you take what I've given you and apply it correctly given your understanding? And now with a true-false section, of course, you only have two answer options. So what if a student guesses? And to counteract that, I've added to that the element of negative marking. In other words, I'm not interested in what you could correctly guess. I'm interested in what you know, what you feel confident enough in answering. So I had set up in 2019 these online assessments for my semester test and my exams where the first section of the paper was the multiple choice questions. There's no negative marking associated with that. But it also includes questions in the multiple choice questions that assess knowledge and a little bit of understanding. For me, the multiple choice section is where a student who has the very basic necessary level of knowledge can use that to pass. The true-false section, which is the second part of the paper, is a little trickier to navigate. You need confidence. You need to feel that you understand the work. And because the risk, of course, is if you give an incorrect answer, that you have a negative one mark applied. Now, I've heard so many horror stories of other modules on campus that use negative marking, where students complain that they got an average of negative 20%, right? So when I thought about the negative marking, I didn't want the negative marking to be punitive in a sense of lowering a student's score per se. I just didn't want them to guess. And I don't want a student to fail because of negative marking, right? So the negative marking component, I keep small enough, or I have it big enough to allow me to distinguish the 75 and above student from the 50% student, but small enough that it doesn't have an impact on whether a student can pass or not, right? And so in 2019, I noticed my class average was around 60% for the module, which for me is and people have their own subjective feeling within their module of what would be a good class average. For me, that's a good class average. It's a healthy class average. Anything below that, I start wondering whether the assessment was perhaps too difficult or whether I didn't prepare my students sufficiently for the assessment. Anything that's above, let's say, 63-64%, I start wondering, is this maybe too easy? And I recall hearing stories during COVID of modules averaging 75% and above, right? So during COVID, my assessment averages were around 63% compared to 2019, which was 60%. And yes, there is a little bit of an increase. And I'm sure that increase has to do with the uninvigilated nature of the online assessment. But I feel that it's still within my broad range of acceptability. Clearly, students might have used their textbook, they might have used their notes, they might have used Google for the knowledge questions. but they could not anticipate the kind of understanding questions or the understanding statements that I would include in a true-false format. They really needed to rely on whether they understood the work or not. So within looking at the time of the assessment, that time does become an invigilator. It does become a pressure point. You can't spend all your time searching on Google for the answers. Eventually, you will run out of time. I included carefully worded, carefully constructed multiple choice questions that maybe took a little longer to read. So maybe the question was quite a dense question and the answer options were relatively short, or the question was relatively short, but the answer options were quite dense. So students, for some of those questions, would really have to sit and think and apply their minds. And then there were other little tricks of the trade that I used with the online assessment, and which I still use, to further discourage collaboration between students, which is also a possibility in the uninvigilated space. For example, I will randomize the presentation of my questions so that two students are unlikely to be answering the same question at the same time. And then I would randomize the presentation of my answer options, so that even if you are answering the same question, I can't quickly send my friend a message saying the answer to question 20 is option A, because their option A would not be the same as my option A. So those are additional techniques that one can use in the online space. And even now during invigilated assessments, I still randomize the presentation of my questions. I mean, another way to do it, of course, would be to have a question bank.
Mm. Yeah.
Right? And then if you can ensure that the level of difficulty across the questions that you're drawing from is comparable, then you could say each student gets a random selection.
Yes.
So that's another way. That's another way to do it.
So moving on from that, Alzeta, I love the thinking about the affordances of technology and how we can utilize that to achieve. So it's not just technology, it's what you wanted to achieve and bringing it together. But a while back, you in the answer, you spoke about initially when they wrote those essays, the no wrong and right answer. How do students respond to that? I assume some of that is still present in your teaching. Tell us a little bit more about that. And my experience has just been that students feel very uncomfortable if we tell them there's no wrong or right answer.
Yes, I share that experience. Students feel insecure. And what I explain to my students when they voice their frustrations that, you know, but what is the answer? Or what do you think? What is your answer? And then I tell them, I'm not going to tell you where I stand in the debate, because you're going to hang on to that as if that is the truth, when it's really just my position. And I can motivate my position, but it might be different from someone else's position. And I use the analogy of astronauts in space. And I tell my students that they are taught in an environment where they don't feel comfortable moving too far away from their textbook. And the textbook is like the spaceship. And so even if they do venture a little bit away from the space, from the spaceship, from the textbook, they still want to be tethered to the textbook, to the spaceship, because then they feel safe. What I want them to do, I want them to develop the skills and the confidence, because that's what it's about. It's about helping students discover their voice, their academic voice, and helping them develop the confidence to take a position that they can motivate, right? And so I give them frequent opportunities in our class discussions to do that, and they will do that in peer-to-peer discussions. I want to give them the skills that they can be the kind of astronaut that's wearing a jetpack and move further and further away from the spaceship, have some level of flexibility and independence in the unknown, Because it is in the unknown, when they step out of their comfort zone, that's where they grow. That's where they learn. It takes courage to operate outside of your comfort zone. And in my module, what I try and do is I create a safe space in the classroom environment, on the SunLearn environment, for students to practice and become accustomed to stepping out of their comfort zone, right? And I use different ways to do that so that by the end of the 6 or 7 weeks of the module, they have a lot more confidence in engaging with the unknown, in bringing their voice to the academic discussion.
Yeah, because learning is a vulnerable space that you're in, right? And Harman, I'm curious about, because we ever so often talk about that creating a safe space. But if you can just share, I don't know, some examples, how practically, how do you create a safe space for your students to, you know, have that courage to step into the void and use that jetpack?
Yeah, that's another topic I've given extensive thought to. When I first started out lecturing, I felt I needed to be a lecturer, right? And so I had an idea in my head of what a lecturer is. This is someone who, they know stuff, they know everything, right? And I found it put a lot of pressure on me because there would be times where students would ask me very good questions that I could not anticipate and that I did not know the answer to, but I felt compelled to find a way to give some kind of smart-sounding answer.
Yeah, from this professor on the pedestal.
Absolutely, absolutely. And eventually I decided this is too much effort, right? Why am I doing this? Why am I showing students that you should always have an answer? Because that's what I'm showing them. I'm showing them that if you want to be someone, you must always have an answer. And so I decided that I'm going to go into my lectures and just be as honest, as authentic as I can be. If I walk into a lecture and I'm feeling low on energy, I'll tell the students when I open the class, I'll say, today is a tough day for me, right? But let's work together and let's give this the best that we can with the energy we have available, so that they can see that I'm a human being that also doesn't want to come to an 8 o'clock lecture on a cold winter's morning, right? So then they would ask questions that I couldn't answer. And I'd say to them, that is an awesome question. I don't know the answer to that. Is there anyone in class who would like to volunteer a thought on this? Or would, what I'd also do is I'd say to students, that is such a cool question. I'd love to know the answer to that. Don't you want to do us a favor? Don't you want to go onto Google? Just spend 20, 30 minutes, see what you can find, and then come back and share that with us. And I think that is the start. By being authentic, by being honest, that is, you show students that you're willing to be vulnerable. You're willing to show yourself to them. And it creates an atmosphere where some students might feel, hey, I can also be real. I can also be me, right? I can also, if the student, if the lecturer asks me a question, I can also say, I don't know. A fantastic illustration of that occurred in my module in the first week, where in the first few lectures, I had told the students, look, there's a lot of preparation work you need to do in advance of our classes, in advance of our discussions. And if you don't do the preparation, then you're not going to get value in the discussions that we have. And in the first discussion class, a student comes up to me and he says, Professor Swart, I did not prepare for today. I'm unprepared. Do I need to leave the class now? Should I stay and still try and have a discussion? And I said to him, your honesty in your reflection of yourself and your own preparation tells me that even if today was an off day for you, that you're the kind of student that's going to come back next week and perform to a level that you're going to make yourself proud and where you can show me what you are really capable of. So please stay, join a discussion group. Hear how your peers discuss the work after they have prepared. And of course, you know, and I love making jokes with my students and sort of just trying to break the ice a little bit. And and I said, come with me. And I took him to a peer discussion group and I said, hi guys, this is Mr. So-and-so. He's not at all prepared for today. Okay, so he's not going to contribute much. But I know he's going to learn from what you guys are discussing. And next week, he's going to bring his A game. This student, after that very inauspicious start, this student is making some of the most incredible contributions to the class discussions. He's earning amongst the top marks in the class. And I'm sure he would have, you know, he would have achieved as well as he has done without me saying anything to him or without him coming to me. But I'd like to believe that showing him that it's okay to have an off day, as long as you are honest with yourself and your own goals that you're setting and whether you've lived up to those or not, then I'm willing to support you because I know what it's like having an off day. So when students ask questions or when they give answers, I have a mantra in my lectures where I tell them, you know, because sometimes I'll ask a question and then I'll hear students murmuring. And I'll say, no, 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 don't whisper the answer. Own it proudly, right? Yeah. Right? Stand up and shout it out. I ask only one thing. If you give the wrong answer, please make sure you get it epically wrong, okay? I want it to be memorably wrong, okay? Because in this space, this is where we fail. We fail constructively in this space because it's safe to fail here. We learn things here. We test our understanding, right? We can get things wrong here so that we can get them right in the assessment where it matters more. Right? We don't want to test whether we understand something or know something in the assessment. We want to test it here so that we can go into that assessment with confidence. And, you know, so students can be taken aback by that approach of, are you saying I must get this wrong now? What do you mean? And so then I'll give them an example from my own experience. And it's one that goes back to when I must have been 9 or 10 years old, sitting in the Afrikaans class. And the teacher asked, kan enig iemand vir my sê wat 'n lettergreep is? Right? Can anyone tell me what a syllable is? But I didn't hear lettergreep. And I was one of those students that would put his hand up and click his fingers who'd want to answer everything. And eventually the teacher lets me answer the question. And I said to her, that's a really bad type of flu. Because I heard griep, not griep, right? And I got the answer epically wrong. But I will never forget what a letter griep is, right?
Yes.
So then I tell students, if you're going to get it wrong, get it epically wrong. So that once you realize just how badly you got the answer wrong, you can have a chuckle at yourself first and foremost, because we must laugh at ourselves, right? But when it comes to the test of the exam and you see the question, the first thing you're going to do is you're going to smile, because you're going to think back to that time you got it epically wrong, right?
Exactly.
And after that, you're going to think about the answer because you're going to know what the answer was.
Yeah.
So for me, that's about some of the ways in which I create that vulnerability or the safe space to make vulnerability. And then I'll also tell students, I've never told, I try not to use the word no or that's wrong. And, you know, I've had students who have the courage to put their hand up and then they'll give a contribution or say something that is so far off the mark. Every time a student puts their hand up, the first thing I remind myself of is their courage to speak out in front of their peers. And sometimes they sort of got the answer correct, and I'll tell them, you're in the ballpark. Let me help you get to the bullseye. Or you're in the ballpark. Is there a classmate that can maybe help you get to the bullseye? If there's a student that has come with something that is epically wrong, I won't tell them that's epically wrong,
yeah.
Right? Even though I've not told them to fail epically, I'll never tell them that was epically wrong.
Mm.
I'll say to them, right, you're thinking about this. That's awesome. Okay, that's the start. Let's think about it some more. And then I'll talk them through it. And then I engage almost in a one-on-one discussion with them, even though there are, you know, 100 other students in the class, so that they can see that even when a student isn't on the right track, that I will respect the courage the student showed, and that I will be gentle with them as I try and guide them towards a better understanding.
Aaron, I wish we could continue for a few more hours, because I have so many more questions and responses to the things you said, but I think we've got to pull this to a close. Though, what I'm picking up here, Al Zed, also from previous podcast discussions, is the theme around vulnerability in assessment. And getting things wrong and learning from getting things wrong. I mean, you opened that door when you shared how your test went wrong, epically wrong earlier. Oh. And I think that's an important thing for us to sit and think about a little bit as assessors.
That's right.
That we can also learn from our assessment mistakes. We never want it to go epically wrong, but if it does. But what I would, in close, what I would like to draw from this is widening our definition of assessment a little bit from your last bit of discussion. It's so tightly intertwined with teaching.
Absolutely.
And I would argue that a lot of what happens there in your classroom space are forms of formative assessment. It's students trying things, getting feedback, learning from it, trying again. So thank you for that. Thank you for bringing that here.
Absolutely, yeah. That is, we often think assessment only happens in that online space where you get the tests or you get the questions. But you have beautifully shared with us that assessment also happens in the discussions in class.
Absolutely.
Before you get to that test or the exam. And and just linking up to what you also shared, Hanley, is Herman, thank you for sharing your learning. And I think another important factor that I take out of this is the importance of reflecting. If we're reflecting upon our own practices, and then also, you know, the courage to not default to the default position, but also for us as lecturers to also enter that space of the unknown, and it's okay to make mistakes. So, yeah. Thank you so much, Herman. Thank you for sharing. And Andy, thank you for anchoring again. And yeah, we look forward to the next podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.